Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for Tuesday, November 21st. I'm Alan Chartok. Congressman John Faso, a Republican from New York's 19th District, is in the studio today. His district encompasses all or parts of 11 counties in the Capital Region, Hudson Valley, Catskills, and Central New York. Have a question for Congressman Faso? Give us a ring. We are expecting a ton of calls on today's program, so get yours in early. 1-800-348-2551. I said 1-800-348-2551. Our civility, Congressman John Faso, your calls and more coming up right after this news. Well, hello again, and welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live daily afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Today, we welcome Congressman John Faso of New York's 19th District to the program. His district encompasses all or parts of 11 counties in the Capital Region, Hudson Valley, Catskills, and Central New York. The first-term Republican serves on the House Budget, Agriculture, and Transportation and Infrastructure Committees. He's a former Republican leader of the New York State Assembly. Congressman Faso graduated from SUNY Brockport and Georgetown University Law Center. He lives in Kinderhook. John Faso, welcome back to the Vox Pop.
Thanks, Alan. Great to be with you. Thanks. Thanksgiving is coming, and that's a great time of year. And wish all of your listeners out there a very wonderful Thanksgiving with themselves and their families.
Nice to hear. Okay, so usually I'd have a little conversation with you, but we just did that for the congressional corner. So let's go right to the phone calls, if
sure.
It's all right with you. No, okay, so we'll go to Christine in Salt Point. Christine, you're on.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, WAMC and Congressman Faso, for making this public forum possible. And particular thanks to Congressman Faso for voting no on the House tax bill.
Oh, thanks,
my question,
Christine,
to Mr. Faso concerns H.R. 38, the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Bill, of which you are a co-sponsor. This bill, as you know, but maybe the listeners don't, would allow people to who have a permit from one state to carry a concealed weapon, to carry that weapon in other states, even if they have previously banned concealed weapons. In the U.S., the number of gun homicides, suicides, and accidents is exponentially greater per capita than in Western European countries. In 2017, thus far, nearly 44,000 people have been victims of gun deaths and injuries. In our country, more than 3,500 of these victims were children or teens.
Okay, respectfully, Christine, it's Alan. I just want to make sure that the board is lit up with a lot of people calling. So, I think we get
all right. We'll get to my question.
Okay, go.
Congressman Faso, do you see H.R. 38 as reducing the horrific number of gun assaults, as in Las Vegas, and gun accidents, as in everywhere in our country and our state? And if so, how?
Christine, thank you, and thank you for your call. I don't see it as reducing gun violence. Gun violence is overwhelmingly committed by people who don't obey the law, who don't go through the process of getting licensed and getting a permit. This legislation would allow people who are validly licensed to carry a handgun in one state to carry it in the other state. But I would point out that it doesn't mean that New York's laws restricting the place and the circumstances of such concealed carry are changed. So someone that would come into New York with a concealed carry permit from Massachusetts or Vermont still has to obey New York law. And I think it's really important. I recognize the statistics you cited, but one of the things that you have not cited, and I think the reason folks don't recognize this or seem to not be aware of it, is that very, very few crimes are committed by people who are valid pistol permit holders. In fact, the vast majority of gun violence in our country takes place with people who are not following the law, who don't have a valid purpose and permit, and are carrying that weapon in violation of the law. So This is a complex issue, as you, I'm sure you appreciate, but the concealed carry bill is much less than it appears and is not really a solution or a impediment to law enforcement or to preventing more gun violence, and because the folks that are committing that violence now aren't obeying the laws.
Thank you, Christine. And on to Rebecca in Kingston. Okay, Rebecca, you're on. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Fassa, for coming in. I was wondering if you approve of the job Mr. Trump is doing and if his history of sexual harassment disqualifies him for the job, in your opinion.
Well, I certainly think that the president has a mixed record. Certain things I would approve of and certain things I don't. And certainly during the campaign when that tape came out that Mr. Trump some years ago was quoted with the fellow Billy Bush, they were doing some Access Hollywood kind of thing. I thought that was pretty awful. And frankly, very disturbing. As a father and as a husband, I found it extremely disturbing. So all of these things are kind of things that the people have to evaluate. And the people, when they elected Donald Trump last year, knew full well the disclosure about that tape, and he was elected regardless. So I think that it's certainly something, this entire business about Harvey Weinstein and now Charlie Rose and the name of the Senate candidate, Roy Moore down in Alabama, all of these things are very disturbing to me. And I think it's about time that these kind of things come to light. And I think it's appropriate that they come to light.
Except that this guy's the president of the United States.
Well, but there was an intervening election in the meantime, Alan. So I think.
Well, but do you think that the electorate is the one who would
call? I think the electorate made the call. Many people didn't like the choice they had.
Isn't a crime a crime? So that a crime isn't nullified by an election?
Well, a crime has to be prosecuted, and it's not up for us to decide who's committed a crime or not. That's up to a validly—
But people are censoring Al Franken for a much lesser crime.
Well, again, I don't think that you could necessarily classify what Al Franken did as a crime. It certainly was highly inappropriate.
Well, no, not a crime, an offense.
Yeah. So I think that these issues are up to validly elected prosecutors to decide to bring charges. I think in the case of Donald Trump, when this came out last year, it probably was beyond the statute of limitations, et cetera. I'm not sure what the date was of that tape, but I believe it was some years before. But be that as it may, I have to tell you, I find this entire thing to be outrageous in terms of the revelations we've heard about different folks. And it'll be up to prosecutors. For instance, in New York City, they're apparently investigating Mr. Weinstein on a potential rape charge. But again, it's not for me. I don't know what the evidence is. I don't know what the witnesses say. I don't know what the proof is. It'll be up to validly constituted prosecutors to make decisions as to whether someone gets charged. And the worst thing we can do, especially those of us who are holding positions of public trust, is to make judgments on whether someone should be accused of a crime or not when we don't have the facts. And I think that would be irresponsible of me to do so.
Thank you, Rebecca. Okay, we'll go to Edward in Ballston Lake. Telephone number, for those of you who want to get in, and there are some free phones, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Edward in Ballston Lake. Edward, you're on.
Yes, Congressman Fassa. My concern is something that's been discussed quite a bit in the past, but seemingly silent at the moment, and that's the national debt with the current legislation that's under consideration and the lowering of the tax levels across the board in some cases. What happened to the discussion about the national debt, and what if it mushrooms? Then what would you cut? So that is my basic question.
Edward, it's a very good question, and it's timely. You know, I serve on the Budget Committee. We currently have $20 trillion of national debt. That's $20,000 billion for those that are keeping track. And we are scheduled, tax cut or no, we are scheduled, we are on track to go to $29 trillion in national debt by 2027. So just 10 years from now, we will be in a situation where the three largest items, if we don't change this trajectory that the federal spending is on, the three largest items in the federal budget will be Social Security, Medicare, and interest on the debt. So I think—
So those would be the programs you would cut if the debt goes up?
Well, here's what I'm saying, Ed. The fact is that the 70%, about 68% actually, of our federal budget, our federal spending is on automatic pilot. That is Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and interest. So 68% of the entire federal budget is mandatory. Mandatory spending is what is driving the increase in the national debt. And this is—
So you would look to cut those programs?
Edward, I didn't say that. What I'm saying is that we do need to reform our mandatory spending so that we slow the growth in that spending. And that, but those are the drivers of our national debt. It's not foreign aid, for instance. I have constituents that come up to me and think 25% of the federal budget is spent on foreign aid. It's about, about a third of 1% is being spent on foreign aid. And, you know,
so are you looking down the road, 10 years, 20 years?
I'm certainly looking in the next 10-year trajectory, which is how the federal budget scorekeepers keep track of federal spending. And so one of the key ingredients to addressing this issue is getting a higher level of economic growth in the country, because more growth means more jobs, more wages, more taxable income, therefore more revenue to the federal government, because the first thing we have to do is
and assume that doesn't occur, what would you do?
Well, I think what we have to do, and what I've said right from the get-go, is we need to reform the trajectory of mandatory spending, because Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid are on unsustainable paths. If you look at your Social Security statement today, you will see that the trustees, who are nonpartisan people of the Social Security system, will say that in 2034, which is just 17 years from now, in 2034, Social Security can only pay 79% of the promised benefits, because we are not growing fast enough as our economy, and we don't have enough work, younger workers coming in behind, backfilling and paying the costs of the those that are either in retirement or near retirement. So it's going to require a national consensus to first understand the problem, educate ourselves as to the solutions to it, and then next, actually get Congress in a national and bipartisan way to save these programs, because the trend lines we're on now are extremely, extremely difficult and scary, frankly, because we have got to address this, or else our kids and our grandchildren are going to be paying this.
Well, I'm concerned that I believe these cuts may be just a lead-in to reducing these social programs that you're so adamantly appears, at least, against.
Well, Edward, again, you're trying to put words in my mouth.
Yeah, you are. Let me be the umpire here. Yeah. He did not say that. He didn't say he was against it. He said there have to be modifications in them. And I think when the Democrats were in control, everybody agreed on that also.
Yeah, this is one of those issues that in politics can easily get demagogued, and people want to adopt either from the left or the right a strident point of view. And really, the middle ground, the responsible ground, in my view, would be for Democrats and Republicans to come together, as Patrick Moynihan and Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill did in the early 80s, and they figured out a 50-year fix to financing of Social Security. That 50 years runs out in about 2034, and this is what I'm getting at. Edward, I encourage you and all the listeners, if you have a Social Security statement that you get in the mail, or if you go online to the Social Security Administration, you can see these facts in black and white. And these are things that we have to do. We have to make sure these programs, which are essential, are protected, but we also have to make sure that there's something for the younger people. The people over 50 don't have to worry about whether Social Security be there for them. The people under 50 really have to worry.
Okay, Edward, thank you very much. We have to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to, of all people, Jeremy from Chatham.
Support for WAMC comes from Patricia Dalton Fennell, founder of AHMA, for over 30 years working to bridge the arts, sciences, and service, now conducting scleroderma research with Lee Shapiro, MD, AlbanyHealthManagement.com. 20 Railroad Public House, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, providing local and seasonably inspired pub fare using antibiotic and added hormone-free meats, local produce, craft beer, cocktails, and wine, 20railroad.com. Saratoga Jewish Community Arts, presenting Son of Saul, a film by director Laszlo Mimes showing The Unshowable of the Holocaust, December 10th, 7 p.m. at Temple Sinai. Reception and discussion to follow, 518-584-8730, extension 2 for reservations. Studio KTM, Red Hook, a hair salon specializing in both adults and children and introducing the Naturalique line of organic and ammonia-free hair coloring products from Denmark. StudioKTM.com. And Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts. AmherstCopy.com.
We're back. Okay. And I promised that we would go to Jeremy in Chatham, who's been patiently waiting. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The first thing I want to say is to make a point about how outrageous it is to cooperate with the president on his tax bill when he refuses to show us his tax returns. And please don't tell me that the election solved that problem. It did not. 3 million people more voted for his opponent. The Electoral College may not care, but the people do. But my real concerns here is the Republican attempts to say things that just aren't true. Like, for instance, the tax cuts will pay for themselves. That's not true. They never have. They may increase revenues temporarily and cover part of the cut, but they do not pay for themselves. Corporations will save us. All we have to do is give them a whole bunch more money. If that were true, we'd be booming right now, because they're flush with profits at record levels. They should get a tax cut when they agree to raise the wages of their 50% of their employees. The other thing is the way this whole thing is phrased. The middle class needs a tax cut. According to the income quintiles, a $60,000 annual household income is right in the middle, okay? Now, a family with two children would pay about $1,100 in taxes. That's less than 2% of their gross income. So if you want to sell all these things, I think you need a better plan, because this is just baloney.
Okay, Jeremy, I take it that's a question. John, you got an answer.
Well, I would put Jeremy down as undecided. Actually, I understand. I understand where you're coming from, Jeremy. I think that the important thing here is, in terms of the corporate side, it's we have tax rates in the U.S. that are extraordinarily higher than they are from our international competitors. So, while,
excuse me.
No, Jeremy. Jeremy. I'm the moderator here. You had quite a while. John's going to answer the question. Go ahead.
Okay. So we have a disproportionate tax burden. 35% is the top rate. Now, it's true that there are exemptions and deductions that will lower the effective rate that a corporation or an individual, for that matter, will pay. But I do think it's important to eliminate exemptions and special preferences that are contained within the tax code in exchange for a lower corporate rate, so that our multinational companies can better compete internationally. And this is one of the fundamental problems that exists. We have the issue where many of our U.S. companies, like Apple, have about $350 billion stashed abroad of U.S. multinational profits earned abroad, where they're taxed once. And if they're brought home, they're taxed again. And this has discouraged the repatriation of U.S. Company foreign earned profits. There are currently between $2.7 and $3.5 trillion worth of U.S. company profits stashed abroad that won't come home. The bill in the House, which I voted against, by the way, bill in the House would deem repatriated those profits at a rate of 14%. The Senate bill would deem those profits repatriated and they'd be taxed at 10%. The profits earned prospectively would be taxed at lower levels to encourage those dollars to come back home. So that's part of...
In all due respect, that wasn't my point. I understand that. What I'm saying is that after all of that is said and done, there is no guarantee or even good hope that they will do that. Did you see the question where they asked the CEOs in the audience, how many of you are going to increase your investments because of the tax cut? Four or five hands went up. There's many other places that money can go.
Okay, Jeremy, there are 10 people behind you. I know that you think you have the only view on this, but
I understand.
You asked the question.
So, Jeremy, I appreciate your concern. I'm concerned that we become competitive in the international arena. I'm not sure that corporate executives raising their hand or not raising their hand actually says much of anything, because frankly, corporate executives sitting in the room with competitors often are going to be reticent to show their hand in terms of that situation. But I appreciate your point of view on this issue, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Okay, we'll go to Dale in Oneonta. Okay, Dale in Oneonta, you're on.
Yes, thank you very much. A couple points I wanted to make about the state and local tax deduction. I heard Representative Collins talking this morning about the cap on property taxes at $10,000, how it wouldn't affect very many people. I think it will affect a large majority of farmers across New York State who don't need another tax increase. But the thing that bothers me about changing the deduction is the amount of money that the states, the prosperous states, New York, California, New Jersey, Connecticut, et cetera, pay to the federal government in excess of what we get back. They're basically providing welfare for states that don't take care of their own people. Okay. The number I heard in New York was $49 billion. If these go through, that'll go higher, and we'll be paying more welfare to take care of states that don't take care of their own people.
Okay, the question is?
The question is why?
Okay, John.
Why take that away?
Oh, no, that was the question. Okay, now we
okay,
get the answer.
Okay, so... Dale, one of the major reasons I voted against the package in the House was the impact upon states like New York by the elimination of the deduction for state income taxes and the partial elimination of the deduction for local property taxes. The one of the things you mentioned about the farmer, for instance, if the farmer is basically that'll be viewed as a business expense. And so those taxes that are not attributable to their personal residence would still be deductible as a business expense. That's one of the anomalies of this whole situation. We're precluding the individual from getting the deduction on their residence, but they were allowing businesses to continue to deduct their state and local taxes on their business tax returns. So that's one of those anomalies that disturbed me in this process. But I think fundamentally what would happen with the loss of this state and local deduction is that many high net worth individuals, many high earners in our state will be tempted to move their businesses and their jobs and their philanthropy out of New York State to lower tax locations around the country. This is already happening throughout New York State, where we see people leaving our state for 180 and plus days plus one to get out of the ambit of New York State taxes. They go to Florida, they go to other places. And I fear that what the elimination of that deduction will do, which is contrary to 104 years of federal policy on the taxation side, what it'll do is accelerate the exodus of successful people and their businesses out of New York State, which is going to hurt all of us.
Thank
right
you.
About that.
Thanks, Dale. Okay, we'll go to Sergio in, Sergio in Colony. All right, Sergio, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call, Alan.
Sure.
I would consider myself a middle-class New Yorker. Right now, with the Republican plan, my tax rate will temporarily go down from 28% to 25%. On top of that, I will lose deductions for medical. I will lose my SALT deductions. I will be capped, et cetera. I've got a son that's going to college in a few years. I will not be able to deduct interest on any college loans I may take out. And there's other deductions that I will be losing,
Sergio,
as a middle-class taxpayer.
Can I ask you a question, Sergio?
May I finish my question, please?
Sure. But you do have to finish it. Yeah, go ahead.
Corporations are going to get a permanent tax cut from 35% to 20% in a time where corporate profits are at record highs. Because of the Wall Street run-up, their shares are more valuable than they've ever been, and they've got trillions of dollars parked offshore because they don't want to bring those profits back to the United States until they get to pay less tax on that. Now, as a middle-class taxpayer, please explain to me how this is a middle-class tax cut.
Well, let me ask you this question, and that's how I can perhaps best answer your question. Do you currently file your taxes jointly with a spouse?
Yes.
And do you have more than $24,000 of itemized deductions?
Yes.
So, the people's definition of what's middle class and what isn't will vary depending on what their income is, I've found in this whole tax discussion. So if you're in a situation where you have less than $24,000 of itemized deductions, then you're likely better off because of the lower rates. Now, if you have more than $24,000 of itemized deductions, the question you have to ask yourself is, would you still, when you lose the deductibility of your state income taxes, including the deductibility of $10,000 in property taxes, would you still be above that $24,000 of itemized deductions? So that's a question people have to ask. On the question of the issue of how many children, if you have kid-dependent children, the House bill would give you a $1,600 credit, which, of course, is worth more than a deduction because it comes right off the amount you owe in taxes. So you have to look at, Sergio, you have to look at where your income falls in the brackets, because this tax plan in the House would lower the rate on much of your income. So you have to subtract what you would pay in lower rates compared to what you might potentially lose by not having the SALT deduction. On the deductibility of
medical,
you have to currently, under current law, have more than 10% of your adjusted gross income, which very few people have.
Let's say that I had some kind of medical situation where my costs now rise above that threshold.
So then
once again, that's going to cost me.
Right, but I understand you to say that you don't have it today. But one of the reasons why I objected to the plan and voted against it was the loss of that medical expense deduction. And the other point you raised in terms of children in college, the deductibility of student loan interest phases out for people over $100,000.
That's what I would, in a lot of places in New York, that's what most people would probably say is a middle class kind of threshold. So once again, I'm going to lose, if let's say I'm in that threshold, I'm going to lose the deduction to send my kid to college.
Well, if you make over 100, if you make over 100 grand now, you'd be losing it anyway. So under current law. So I think that the
under current law.
That's right.
That's right. We're talking about a law that you're working on now.
No, I'm saying under the current system that the deductibility of student loan interest is phases out for people more than $100,000. So if hypothetically you had $2,000 worth of deductible interest and you were right at that $100,000 level, that deduction of $2,000 is probably worth about $400 of reduced taxes. So people have to analyze this thing carefully from the perspective of their own situation. I looked at this, obviously, from the perspective of people's individual situations in different income ranges, but also from the perspective of the state as a whole. And I concluded that this would be harmful to the state as a whole because we're going to drive away many of those high earners and their businesses, and that will have a damaging impact upon the state's revenues and therefore our school aid, et cetera. So that's how I came to the conclusion that I did, Sergio, but I appreciate your call and I hope
No, Sergio. There are 10 people behind you. They're all cursing not only you but me.
Thank you, Alan. I just wanted to know, you know, why is mine temporary? Why is corporations permanent?
That's a good question.
That is a good question. The reason is because the Congress is doing this legislation through the vehicle of called budget reconciliation. And,
yes, I understand it.
And so for accounting purposes, certain of the tax credits or like the 179 business write-off for equipment, those expire after 5 years. And this is a budgetary gimmick, if you will, or strategy. And it's a strategy if you like it. It's a gimmick if you don't.
Well, Sergio and I aren't buying it. Thank you very much, Sergio. Appreciate
it. Thank
you, Alan. Yeah, bye. Okay, and now we're going to go to, what the heck here? This is all different. Huh. I don't know. All of these have gone. Okay, we'll go to Aryeh in Niskayuna. Okay, Aryeh, you're on. You're on. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I just have a question because in 2 weeks I'm actually moving back to Germany permanently. And often when I tell people this, many say things like, oh, with the current administration, I don't blame you. I would too. I've looked into this. And it's kind of made me wonder if you and other people are potentially worried about a brain drain, especially among young adults.
Okay, we have 2 minutes.
Like the grad school tuition waiver.
Okay, we got 2 minutes to 1 minute now to answer this before the break.
The answer is I'm not worried about that. I do think that I'm more worried about the drain of people out of New York State than I am to abroad, because regardless of your opinion about the current administration or the status of our politics and political discourse, which is often pretty bad in my view, we still live in a very great country. We have the rule of law, we have a constitution, and we have much to be thankful for here in the United States.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Support for WMC comes from the Egremont Barn, country music with Monica Rizzio on Friday, November 24th at 8 p.m. Dinner served at 5 p.m. Tickets at theegremontbarn.com. Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts and service to customers throughout western Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years. BoydenAndPerrin.com. Wild Bird Junction, 308 Delaware Avenue, Delmar, offering wild bird seed, bird feeders, and houses, heated bird baths, binoculars, nature jewelry, gifts, toys, and games, where people and nature come together. WildBirdJunction.com. Bergeron Electrical Services. For over 30 years, providing the Pioneer Valley and Western Massachusetts with all electrical services, interior and exterior lighting, generator installation, and more. BergeronElectrical.net. And Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, Old South Street, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Dairy and no moo, dairy free. Handmade artisan ice cream, sweet baked goods, hot fudge, and more. Harolds.com.
Okay, it's Alan. I'm here with John Faso. We have many, many people on the phones. So we only have, this is the third time. So I guess we got about 15 minutes to go. I want to ask that you ask your questions really quickly. And, John, as much as possible, you give your answers really quickly. Okay, let's go to John in Kingston. Oh, John in Kingston, you're on. Go ahead, John.
Hello, how are you?
Good, go ahead.
Congressman Faso, thanks a lot for meeting with us in virtual space.
Sure.
What would you propose to do to hold corporations accountable so that they don't offshore jobs and assets like has happened in the Mid-Hudson Valley in one instance done by a large computer manufacturer of our acquaintance? it's really, there's been 15 years of them selling the shelving, and it's not just one company, it's many.
Okay, fair enough, John. Fair enough. We're going to get an answer. Go
well,
ahead.
One of the things is to try to make our companies competitive on a tax basis, avoid these so-called inversions where companies have actually, because of U.S. tax code issues, have tried to move their headquarters to places like Ireland or Canada or other places. And those inversions are a distinct and perverse aspect of the existing tax code. Get the foreign, the U.S. Foreign earned profits, which are taxed abroad when they're earned, stop taxing them at a high level when they come back to the United States. And both these bills will do that. So I think those are things to try to incentivize companies to have more jobs and businesses and investment here in the United States.
Okay, thanks, John. Let's go to Paul in Hillsdale. Paul in Hillsdale. Okay, Paul, go ahead.
Thank you. Now that the proposed corporate rate will be 20%, tell me what corporate tax deductions they're giving up.
My understanding is that some of the deductions in terms of certain business expenses that are routinely deducted are being eliminated. Certain expenses
specific.
For sending the moving facilities and jobs overseas, those are being eliminated. And I believe that the overall goal here is to eliminate some of the preferences and special interest things that may be geared towards specific industries. So, look, this is a...
You mean like the oil depletion allowance? Is that going to be given up?
That has been largely changed through the years, so I'm not specifically certain about that one, Paul, but I'm going to take a look at that. Thanks for bringing it up.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Let's go to, let's see here, Marcia in Postenkill. Okay, Marcia in Postenkill, you're on.
Thank you. I live in the Congressman's district and contacted him about House Resolution 81 recently regarding ending U.S. military support to Saudi Arabia in their bombing and blockading of Yemen, and I didn't get an answer that addressed that. I got an answer that we give aid to Yemen. So my question is, please explain what you think justifies our help to Saudi Arabia against the poorest country in the world where most of the people are starving because of the bombing and blockade.
Marcia, thanks for bringing it up. And I tell you, I think this is a very difficult situation. I don't know if you saw the 60 Minutes piece that was on the other night. But it was quite shocking and heart-rending for the people that are being affected by this. This is, in essence, a proxy war going on with the Houthis, the rebels supported by the Iranians, and the Sunni Yemenis being supported by the Saudis. The best thing we can do as the United States is to really pressure the sides to have a ceasefire and to bring assistance to the people that desperately need it, because there not only are food and famine issues, there are diseases like cholera that are affecting a lot of the people in that country. And it is a really difficult situation. We have a lot of issues vis-a-vis the Saudis in terms of the Middle East generally, where we are on the same side as they.
Well, are we too close to them? Should we separate out from them?
Well, I think it's a difficult issue because of the issues in Syria and in the Middle East generally. One of the ironies is that the Israelis and the Saudis now actually have, while it's not public, they actually have very good relations. And so this is a very bad situation. The caller is right, Marcia. And I'm concerned about the situation in Yemen, as are you. And I think we need to do more to pressure the parties to have a ceasefire and bring aid to those people who are desperately in need of it today.
Marcia, thank you. Okay, we're going to go to, let's see here, Bernadette in Highland. Okay, Bernadette, you're on. Bernadette.
Yeah, thank you. The comment I wanted to make is that over the years, I'm 65 years old, and over the last 50 years, all I keep hearing about is how the federal government have drained Social Security to pay for war efforts, or even a Cold War effort. And if that money was put back into Social Security, I bet you we'd be having an easier time.
Well, the question is, John, and it's a good one, I think, Social Security has a huge fund, And the United States government has been borrowing from that fund over the years. So for whatever reason, if they had left it alone, we'd be ahead of the game. No?
Well, it's true that this started in 1969, I think, or 68, when the Johnson administration, they started a unified federal budget, and that included all revenues that came into the federal government, including Social Security. And for the last number of years, initially those Social Security surpluses masked deficits on the federal side, but the last number of years and I don't know if it's 5 or 7 or 8, but as we're seeing the baby boomers retire, what's happening is that the debt that the federal government owes Social Security now has to be repaid. The government gave Social Security promisory notes, and so this is what's going on with the Social Security system. So the fundamental problem, Bernadette, is demographics in our country. We have many more people who are retiring, who are living longer, which is great and good, but we're retiring, living longer, and we have fewer people who are paying in. When the system started many years ago, there were 8 or 10 people paying in for every person receiving benefits. We will soon be in a situation where there are only 2 people paying in for every person receiving benefits. And that's why I've suggested that, just like Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill and Moynihan did back in the early 80s, we need to get a consensus between the parties and among the public as to how do we fix this, because largely what ails Social Security is demographics.
So what do you want to do? Do you want to raise the amount, the age before somebody gets Social Security?
Well, that's already being done.
Well, raise it more.
And, well, there are only 3 options, Alan. One, the age is affected in terms of the time in which you can receive full benefits. That's happening today. Many people who are retiring now can only get their full benefit if they're 66 or above, and this is going to go up to 67 under current law. The other option is raise taxes, and the amounts subject to Social Security go up every year by an inflation factor. In this coming year, it's going to be $128,600, I think, of income that is subject to Social Security taxes. And the other issue is adjust benefit levels prospectively affecting people who are not yet retired. Those are the 3 options that have generally been out there. But in order for people to accept any of these options, or all of them, or part of them, the only way to do it is so that the leaders in our nation and Congress explain to the public what the situation is and provide the facts so that people can understand what's going on. But the overriding reason why Social Security finance is in trouble come 2034, and Bernadette, take a look at your Social Security statement. It says it right on there in the fine print. The overriding reason is demographics, not government manipulation of the revenue or anything like that. It's demographics that are driving our destiny, as Nathan Glaser once said, and that's what's going on here.
Thank you, Bernadette. Okay, we'll go to Caroline. No, no, we won't either. We're going to go to, I don't know where we're going.
We got to be quick, Alan.
Yeah, you're so right. Let's go to Sasha in Albany. Sasha, you're on. Go ahead, Sasha.
Hello, Congressman Faso. I'm calling about legislation that has been introduced as part of the House's tax bill to open up the Arctic Refuge, which is a federally protected land and one of the most pristine and biologically diverse ecosystems in our country, for drilling and oil exploration in order to cover deficits in the tax bill. I think that this is a nearsighted strategy, and it puts short-term gains and dirty oil over our environment. Congresswoman Stefanik, as well as 9 other congressional members, have signed onto a letter opposing this provision. My question to you is, will you oppose a tax bill which incorporates this provision for drilling in an Arctic refuge, federally protected lands?
Just one correction, Sasha. It's in the Senate bill. This is put in at the behest of Senator Murkowski from Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
It was not in the House bill. I'm frankly not wild about this issue. I have studied this a little bit, and I've talked to people from things like the Wilderness Society, which are very strongly opposed, And I think that it's inappropriate to have this in the tax reform bill.
Question asked, question answered. Okay, let's go to Eli in Utica. Okay, Eli, make it short.
Hi, John, thank you for voting no. Express my disappointment in Congresswoman Penny, who voted yes to punish the taxpayers of New York. Two questions for you, John. First, are you aware of the Heritage Foundation's study on tax repatriation? Cut to the chase, their analysis of the 2004 Bush repatriation says that it brought meager jobs and meager reinvestment to the country, and they feel that this year's repatriation would be even worse. So
okay,
I
Eli,
wish you would read.
Okay, Eli, Eli, whoa, Eli, I'm trying to get everybody in here.
Okay, Eli, I'm aware of the Heritage analysis from 2003. I think the reason that was not a success is that it wasn't permanent. It was just a temporary thing. I think making permanent law in this regard will be much more successful than the prior example.
All right. Thank you, Eli. And now on to Richard in Schenectady. Okay, Richard in Schenectady, you're on. Go ahead.
Yes. Good afternoon, gentlemen. If most of the tax cuts percentage-wise go to those with the greatest income, this increases the income gap to a greater extent than it already is.
Okay.
Greater incomes gave a greater disproportionate influence to the wealthy when it comes time to make campaign contributions prior to the election.
What's the question?
So why, with that in mind, is that not one of the I can't help but think that's one of the reasons behind the tax cuts being structured the way they are. Would you comment on that, please?
I really don't think so. In fact, what you're seeing in New York State.
Hey, Richard, did you break the rule and have your radio on? Because if you are, you got to listen on the phone, but turn it off the radio. Go ahead.
No, they're both off. They were before I called you.
Okay, we're getting some here. Go ahead.
That was Alan just giving you feedback. So, the bottom line is that most of the tax reduction on the individual side is geared towards the middle class, particularly if you have kids. You're right in the sense that that the wealthy pay a large percentage of the taxes. The concern I have, again, and this was one of the reasons, main reasons I voted against, is that this is going to drive, it's going to raise taxes on successful people and business owners who can no longer deduct their state taxes and only a limited deduction for their state, their local property taxes. And that, I fear, is going to accelerate the exodus of successful people and their businesses out of our state. And that's going to really harm our school aid and other programs that New Yorkers rely on.
Well, but there are many people, John, just for the hell of it, just say this. All the analysis that I've been reading in the New York Times and other places is that the wealthy make out like bandits in this.
I think that analysis is really often incorrect, and it just depends.
The New
York
Times? Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's often incorrect because it doesn't consider a couple of things. The Tax Policy Center, for instance, put out data that they had to retract because they didn't count the value of the child tax credits for middle-class families. So I think that it's very important, as I said before, for people to want to look at this themselves, look at it in terms of how much you itemized last year and what if it's under $24,000 and you're married filing jointly. The loss of these deductions doesn't affect you, but it could affect us globally as a state, and that's my problem with it.
Thank you, Richard. Okay, over to Barbara. Very quickly, Barbara, we're running out of time here. Number 8. Okay, Barbara in Stone Ridge. Go ahead.
Yes, Congressman. I'm just wondering if you have made any decisions on the Disability Integration Act that was introduced by Congressman Gibson right before his term ended. We've spoken a couple times about this, and just wondering if you had time to research it and make a decision.
Yeah, I think it's a good proposal, and I appreciate your bringing it to my attention.
All right, and to Suzanne in Dutchess County. Suzanne, it's got to be real fast. Go ahead.
Hi. I've just been bothered by the fact that all the news reporting for the last, since they've been talking about this, refers to high property states of California, New Jersey, New York. And it annoys me that they can't find some other adjectives because you don't even have to live in New York to have benefit. You know, it's partly because the property is that it actually is worth more in those places.
Okay, very quickly, John, you got to answer okay. Because no, we don't have any time. Go ahead, John.
I live in Ohio.
I'm going to hang up on you because I'm sorry to do that.
I'm not sure I got what the question was, though, Alan.
Yeah.
I think the fact is, we have high property values, but the one of the concerns in the bill, in the House bill, for instance, is that it would limit the value of a mortgage. It's now $1 million. It would reduce it, the deductibility for mortgage expense for mortgages 500 or below. And that's prospective, not affecting current mortgages. And that could affect property values.
Thank you, John. We're out of time. And I want to thank everyone who called in. And I apologize to those who I have treated quickly. And I want to thank Congressman John Faso of New York's 19th District for joining us on the program. Support for the Vox Pop comes from Hawkins House, Bennington, Vermont, a crafts market featuring Ed Levin and other handcrafted jewelry, pottery, blown glass, woodenware, clothing, handbags, accessories, Vermont products, and more. HawkinsHouse.net. New World Catering by Rick Orlando, now offering Thanksgiving dishes from scratch and local sides to go from Saugerties and Albany Kitchens. NewWorldCatering.com. The Discovery Center, presenting November programs featuring the 9th annual Waddle Walk, an exploration into the worlds of owls, deer, and turkeys. This Saturday, November 25th, AlbanyPinebush.org. The Tang Teaching Museum and Arts Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and exceptional programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop today. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. And thank you, John Faso. Stay tuned now, everybody, for a news update.